Okay, tonight's introduction to learning Gemara, to the study of the Talmud, is geared to answer the following questions, not in any particular order, but what is Gemara? And why do we study Gemara? Why has the study of Gemara, of the Talmud, fascinated the minds of the greats throughout so many centuries, even thousands of years? What are the commentaries on the Gemara, and which ones are primary, which ones are secondary? What did each one add? Another question I'd like to address tonight: is the Talmud a code of Jewish law, a code of halacha? Should it be like a substitute for the Shulchan Aruch? And if it's not, how is it different than the Shulchan Aruch? Another question is, can the Talmud be divided into parts? Is there a difference between what we call halacha and agada in the Talmud? Obviously there is, but what is that difference? Another question we'd like to address tonight is the Gaonim period, which is the period that followed the creation of the Talmud. So tonight we want to get an idea, sort of a breath, a flow of the Torah and its parts, how the Torah led to the Gemara, when was the Gemara written, who wrote the Gemara, who followed the writing of the Gemara after it was closed, what are the rules and regulations that apply to those who wrote the Gemara and those who came after the Gemara, before the Gemara and after the Gemara. And finally, I want to discuss the significance of Aramaic. Why is the Gemara in Aramaic? Why is it necessary for us to break our teeth in the Aramaic? Why not jump over to the art scroll and learn it in English? And finally, the key question for tonight is, why study Gemara? Okay then, let's get to it. This introduction may take more than the time allotted to us tonight, but that's fine, because we'll have, Amir Tzashem, another opportunity on the following Sunday night. What is Gemara? Our sages have told us the following. Moshe kibel Torah mi Sinai. Moshe received the Torah at Har Sinai. We're going to rewrite that statement. We're going to write it this way. Moshe kibel shtei Torot b'Sinai. Moshe received not one Torah, but two. Very often, a teacher will ask his students, how many Torahs do we have? And of course, the knee-jerk response is, there's only one Torah, right? But that's not true. There's the oral Torah, and there's the written Torah. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure which is more important. Well, that's not exactly true. I know which one is more important, but I'm not going to tell you that because I want you to guess. We start with the written Torah. The written Torah includes, first and foremost, the five books of Moses, the five Chamisha Chumshei Torah, and secondly, all of the Torah, the Tanakh itself, is made up of how many books? What's the magic number? How many books are there in Tanakh? Well, everybody knows that, but don't all answer at once. 24, that's the magic number, okay? So we have the 24 books of the Holy Writ. And Moshe was given all of them. Leave out all the questions that are flooding your mind at this point about how Moshe could have received, for example, the book of Yoshua, etc., 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 when all those Nevi'im, all those prophets, were after Moshe Rabbeinu. That's a question which the Ramban, Nachmanides, touches upon in his introduction to the Torah, to Sefer Bereishit. For that, you'll have to come to a different class of mine. A little bit more south, you know, in the middle there, Clanton Park. But, be that as it may, we have the 24 books of the written Torah. The written Torah includes a tremendous amount, not the least of which is how many mitzvot? 613 mitzvot. But the Torah includes a lot more than the 613 mitzvot. It includes all sorts of ideologies and philosophies and tenets of the faith and histories and stories about how the golden chain of Knesset Yisrael that we call the Jewish people was formulated, was formed over the course of time. So there's a wide gamut, a tremendous scope that's included under Torah. But what's common to all this is that the written word is critical. So here we're looking at letters, words, sentences, paragraphs, chapters, books, etc., etc. We're seeing things with our eyes. And then there was another Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's the oral Torah. That's called Torah Shebaal Peh. There what's critical is not the power of sight, but rather the power of hearing, speaking, to transmit from Rebbe to Talmud. Moshe kibel Torah Misinai u'misora, and he passed it on. So Moshe gave us not only the written Torah, which was committed to writing, and a whole issue arises exactly when Moshe wrote the Torah. Was it written in segments at different points in Moshe Rabbeinu's life, or was it written all at once? But be that as it may, it's not relevant to what we want to discuss tonight. What we want to put the emphasis on is not the written Torah, but what? The oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now I'm going to ask you a trick question. So since I told you it's a trick question, you won't fall into my trap. Of the 613 mitzvot that are incorporated in the Torah, how many of them are elucidated by the oral Torah? And how many are not? Can anyone think of any mitzvah that's given in the Torah which is crystal clear, the principles, the underlying rules and regulations that govern that mitzvah and tell us exactly how to observe that mitzvah are crystal clear, are self-contained in the written Torah? How many mitzvot can we come up with that fit that description? And what's the answer? None. There's not one single mitzvah of the 613 that could be understood in its complete way without the oral Torah. Rav Shimshon Lefel Hirsch, who lived about 150 to 200 years ago, he was the father of the modern German Orthodox movement. He came up with the following paradigm. He said, suppose you're a student in a class. Right, now today we're a little more sophisticated, but in those days it was literally impossible to write down, to transcribe every word that came out of the teacher's mouth. So what did you do instead if you were a studious student? You took notes, exactly. Those notes are what we call an outline form. The outline form is general, but not too specific. You don't have time to write down all the details. So in the Nimshal, what he tried to explain, Rav Hirsch, is that the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, is sort of an outline. The details are not there. Therefore, you cannot understand the Torah Shebichtav. Take, for example, the mitzvah of tzitzit. Well, what does it look like? And when do I wear it? How many knots do I need? What about the mitzvah of tefillin? L'totafot bein einecha. Anybody have a clue what totafot means? And take, for example, the mitzvah of lekachtem lachem, which we just observed during the days of Sukkot. The four minim. Well, what do these species look like? Even the moral laws, my friends, something as natural, as instinctive as kibud av v'em, as honoring one's parents. Okay, the Torah says kaved et avich v'et imecha. It's up there in the Decalogue. But how? When? Under what circumstances? The avadatem et Hashem Elokeichem. You should serve your Lord, the God, which means tefillah, which means prayer. When do I pray? How do I pray? What are the necessary elements and components? And we can go like that through every single one of the Taryag mitzvot and come to the conclusion that having studied Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, and having mastered every word, and I know it by heart, I don't know zippo about the mitzvot. I just know general principles. But how and when and where, the details are left out. All that, the whole kit and caboodle, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh, the entire gamut, what we call Torah, was given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. Part of it was written, the other part was oral. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to transmit not just the written Torah, which was easy because you could see the letters, but the oral Torah. And that transmission, called the transmission of Torah Shebaal Peh, is what opens up an entire chain which is delineated by that same Mishnah at the very beginning of Masechet Avot. Moshe Rabbeinu passes the Torah to Yoshua, and Yoshua to the Zakenim, and the Zakenim to the Anshei Knesset. This entire chain of tradition and transmission of the Torah. Does anybody know which author throughout Jewish history was the individual who got so specific about the chain of tradition, how the oral Torah was transmitted from Rebbe to Talmud, Talmud to Rebbe, Bezdin to Bezdin, from one court to the other court over the course of history? Anybody know who I have in mind? Who got so specific about it?
The Rambam.
The Rambam, exactly. The Rambam wrote many different works, Maimonides, and the greatest of which, the magnum opus, if you will, is called the Mishnah Torah, the Mishnah Torah, otherwise known as the Yad Chazaka, but the Rambam himself called it the Mishnah Torah. And the Rambam has an introduction to the Mishnah Torah. In his introduction to the Mishnah Torah, he gives us an overview of the various generations taking us from Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai all the way up to he himself, to the Rambam himself, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon. And he goes into very specific details about who is there to receive the Torah and who is to choose. We're going to come back to this point over and over and over again, because I cannot overemphasize how significant it is in our tradition to attribute every stage and every statement in the transmission of the Torah to a particular rabbi. So-and-so says. Not only that, it gets even more specific. So-and-so says in the name of so-and-so, who heard it in the name of so-and-so. And we end up with what we call in Passover terms, Echad Gadya. And why is this so important? But the tradition has to be pinpointed, has to be attributed to the particular rabbi. And that's what the Rambam does for us. He lays out the entire scope, the entire picture of the history. We're going to come back to this point in Mirtz Hashem again. So there's a tradition, a transmission of the oral Torah. As the Mishnah says in Avot, one generation to the other, and this is how we understand the Torah. The Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, includes A, elucidations, B, principles, C, details, and D, the connection between the oral Torah and the written Torah. And this D, this last point that I mentioned, cannot be overemphasized. Because what we're going to see time and time again is what's the source. You come up with a halakha, some sort of law, some sort of tradition. Where's the biblical source for it? Even when you start a masechta, when you start a new gemara, the first question that very often comes up is what's specific scriptural source, what verse in the Torah are we talking about? What's the background? And so what we try to do is try to understand the connection between the oral Torah and the biblical Torah, and the biblical law. That's going to be what's the source. Okay, keep that question in mind. What's the source?
Is the oral that you're referring to now, are you talking the writer, Moshe Messina?
Yeah, like for example...
Or are you speaking of the rabbinic Mishnah Gemara as...
No, for example, I'll give you an example, Lawrence. Take for example, the first Mishnah in Shas says, Me'ematai korin kriyat shma bi'arvit. This is a biblical requirement to read kriyat shma at night. And when does that begin? Does it begin with sunset? Does it begin halfway between sunset and the stars coming out, after the stars come out, etc., etc., etc.?
No, but that Mishnah is rabbinic law.
No, not at all.
Not the source of it, but the Mishnah itself is rabbinic.
I don't know what you mean by rabbinic. You know, if you talk about rabbinic law, then you're talking about putting a fence around the Torah, protecting us, decrees, hachakot, what we call. That's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a mitzvah min haTorah, the Torah law of Kriyat Shema. The Mishnah wants to know, well, the Torah omitted a very important detail. At what point does that mitzvah begin? What's the kickoff of that mitzvah? Is it with sunset? Is it with Seitako Chavim, when the stars come out? Here we're dealing with the Doraita. So the first question of the Talmud is, Tana Heichakai, where are you coming from? Is there a biblical source for the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema? And the answer is going to be what? Bishogbecha uvkumecha, when one goes to sleep and when he rises. So what came first? Going to sleep or rising? Going to sleep. So therefore the first question that the Mishnah is going to address, this is the first Mishnah in all the Talmud, in all the Gemara, the first Gemara in all of Shas, is when do we begin the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema Shel Arvit, at night? So the Gemara says, why did you start with the night? Because the Torah itself started with the night. B'shogbecha, when I go to sleep, u'b'kumecha. Why do I mention this Gemara to you? Because it's so indicative of what the oral tradition is all about. Find me a source in the Torah, in the Bible, a pasuk in Chumash, and now raise a question about the details of that particular verse. Namely, you tell me that when I go to sleep, I have to recite Kriyat Shema. But when? Somebody could go to sleep in the middle of the day, in the middle of the night. When? Do you follow me? So that point has to be emphasized. That even though we say that Moshe Rabbeinu received two Torahs, the written Torah and the oral Torah, what's critical is to find the connection between the two. The oral Torah always has to be connected to the written Torah. And I'm not talking about rabbinic institutions now. Okay, fine. Let's go on to the next point.
Can I ask a really basic question?
Yeah, please.
Isn't it a mistake to refer to the Torah as the oral Torah and the
Chumash? Yes, it really is, because the Chumash is written, and the oral Torah is not written. So whenever you hear the word oral Torah, immediately in your mind, you know it's not written. So you'll ask me, but Rabbi Grosser, how can you tell me it's not written? I mean, I have in front of me a Gemara, right? So it is written. So that's what we're going to talk about now. That at some point in Jewish history, the oral Torah was committed to writing. But what I need you to appreciate is that that was a radical breakthrough. And it was antithetical to the very difference, a very fundamental difference, a difference between the written Torah and the oral Torah. So again, even though we're going to learn the oral Torah from a written text, that's not really what it's all about. The oral Torah, even if it's committed to writing, always remains an oral Torah. It never becomes a written Torah. And again, that sounds paradoxical, almost antithetical, but we're going to come back to that, and that's going to be the main point in this whole discussion that we have, to appreciate what Gemara is all about, that the Gemara remains, despite it all, an oral Torah. How could that be? After all, I go into a bookstore, there's one right here, right? What's it called, the Sfarim Warehouse, and I buy a Shas. And if I, you know, if I want to impress my new son-in-law who's engaged to my daughter, you know, I'd say, hey, which shas do you want me to buy? And here's a shas, Bavli and Gemara, and I'm going to spend who knows how much money on it. So it's written? No, it's not written. It always remains oral. We'll explain that as we go. Correct? Okay.
My question about that, quick question. It's not always...
Okay, you got to give me time to develop this. Again, I don't expect you or me or anyone here in this room to understand how I can tell you that the Mishnah and the Gemara, which is clearly written, still remains oral. Okay, I don't expect you to understand. Right now, it should be totally antithetical. Okay. Wait, give me one more minute. Wait. One more minute. Now, why did the oral Torah get committed to writing? Well, my original question is, what is Gemara? So we're halfway towards an answer to that question, what is Gemara? The first half that we've gone is the following. Moshe received how many Torahs? Two. The written Torah and the oral Torah. The oral Torah is the Gemara. But we're not there yet. To say that the oral Torah is the Gemara is a mistake, because the Gemara is written and the oral Torah is not written. So the question that we have to answer is, in order to understand what Gemara is, how did this evolution take place? Who was responsible for it? Why did he do it? And at what point in history was the oral Torah committed to writing. So let's take it one by one. Who is responsible in Jewish history for this revolution in which a transformation takes place, although I still maintain that it always remains the oral Torah, but in which the oral Torah becomes committed to writing? Anyone? Everyone? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, approximately the year 200 in the Common Era, maybe a little bit before, edits what we call the Mishnah. And now we have to talk about the Mishnah. When Rebbe writes the Mishnah or edits the Mishnah, the Rambam points out he doesn't start ex nihilo out of nowhere. What was the situation before Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi? So the Rambam describes a Rebbe would get up, a teacher, and teach his pupils. There was at least one pupil in the class who would write notes. He would commit to writing the ideas that were transmitted to him and to the rest of the class from his teacher. One student in each group was more or less responsible. There may have been others, it could have been a group effort, but primarily it was one individual who singled out to take the Torah that he heard, the oral transmission, and write notes. And the Rambam goes through which individuals were it that played that major role throughout history, up until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. In each generation, there was one primary student who was a great note taker, he was a great scholar. Obviously, the two had to go together because it's not just enough to write notes, you have to understand what you're hearing in order to write clearly. What's the difference, my friends, between those notes and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's, as I called it before, revolution, his breakthrough in editing the Mishnah?
In a systematic way.
It wasn't systematic. What else? There's something much more fundamental.
Who got the notes after?
Who got the notes? Up until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, where were those notes? Were they public or private?
Private.
They were private. This is what we'll see in the Talmud is called Megillat Sterim. Again, I don't want to confuse you. If you've ever heard the term, great. If you haven't, leave it out. But basically, that term indicates that any note-taking was for private consumption only. You didn't hear the Rebbe's class today? Come over to me. I'll show you my notes. But it all was done sort of behind closed doors. The first and only attempt until that point in history to take those notes and, as you say, systematically organize them, but more importantly, more fundamentally, to publicize them. That means that anyone could have access to these notes. Anyone would study these notes and teach, pass on the tradition based on what he saw in those notes. That was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Now I'm going to ask you again a trick question. Halachically, according to Jewish tradition, was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi allowed to do what he did? The answer is no. Why? Because there's a fundamental distinction between the written Torah and the oral Torah. And we're going to have to understand why. Why is our tradition so opposed to writing the other Torah? We mentioned Rav Shimon Sofer Hirsch. Okay, good. So you took notes in an outline form, and then you have the written Torah, but now every single detail has to be elucidated, and that's the oral Torah. Our tradition emphasizes and accepts that difference. That fundamental difference must be there. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, in a sense, was overstepping his bounds, violating the license that he had by taking notes and publicizing them, arranging them in a form that was accessible and ultimately became obligatory for every single student of the oral Torah. Why did he do so? Why? What happened historically?
Because of persecution.
Exactly. The word here is galut. The Jews were now spread out throughout the world, persecuted. You all know that when a non-Jew comes to convert to Judaism, the first thing we tell such a person, male or female, is that, what are you, out of your cotton picking mind? You want to join this people that are near Duff and this, that persecuted of this tremendous persecution and the widespread dissolution of the people. Torah Shebaal Peh was in disarray. The arrangement, the original system, was breaking down. It wasn't working. Why? Disputes arose. People had different traditions. There was no central body that was organizing and determining what the Torah Shebaal Peh was. So everyone in their own community was saying, well, I have this tradition. I understand it this way. And as a result, the Torah was in danger of being totally lost. Because as I said before, there's no Torah Shebichtav without Torah Shebaal Peh. One of the things that we fast about is the fact that the Torah Shebichtav was translated first into Greek. Because if you have Torah Shebichtav without the Torah Shebaal Peh, it could lead to such a disruption and such a corruption of the Torah itself. And now, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, was in fear, was in danger, in jeopardy of being lost, of being totally corrupted. So as a result of the diaspora and the persecutions that got worse and worse and more severe, the future of the oral Torah was in jeopardy. At that point, when Rav Yehuda HaNasi realized, together with the other members of his court, he was the head of a Beit Din, that court made a decision. We call it in Hebrew, but again, I don't want to confuse you, it's not important. Ein la'asot l'Hashem eferet Torah, that sometimes, for the sake of saving the Torah, we may have to violate it. It's a pragmatic rule. Isn't it true even in medicine that sometimes, you know, you have to sacrifice a limb to save the person? This is what was going on. Rav Yehuda HaNasi said, if we don't commit the Torah to writing, if there's not one universal book that could be accessed and taught to the entire Jewish community straight across the globe in any part of the diaspora, then we might lose the whole adventure, the whole endeavor. And therefore, together with his Beit Din, which was the authority at that time, the Mishnah was edited. Had a review done us, he do it. He collected the writings of the greats over the course of centuries as they were passed on through the tradition, and he sat down and he edited. But here's the point, and if you get this next point, you get it all. Because this is where Gemara became a necessity. I ask you a true or false question, and you'll all know the answer. Did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi take the license to the extreme, and once permission was granted, he would be verbose, he would be extensive, he would be detailed? Is that true? No, that is false. What is true is that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, pardon the expression, was stingy on ink. I don't mean that literally. He could afford the ink. He was a very wealthy guy. But he tried as much as he could to abridge the Torah, to limit it as very few sentences as he possibly could. Why? What pushed Rav Yehuda HaNasi, when he authored the Mishnah, to be so limited in how many words he would write? And what's the answer?
So we could learn it out from those words. Make you think?
Oh, no, that's more advanced. We're not ready for thinking. What we're ready for is to maintain as much as possible the oral nature of the Torah Shebe'al Peh. Keep in mind, our tradition has it that the oral law should be oral. Okay, we're in a do or die situation, right? You try to limit it as much as possible. You know, if let's say a person is ill and he has to eat on Yom Kippur because so the physician tells him, you know, his life is in danger. Are you going to tell him that maybe he should eat from day till from dawn to dusk? I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe he should eat whatever he has to eat to maintain his health. But it's not, Purim Kippurim, but it's not Purim. You know, he shouldn't be getting drunk on Yom Kippur just because he's a chol, he's a sick person. So we need to salvage the Torah. But says Rebbe, I'm going to do it in such a way. Like, for example, you'll see, and this is going to, again, we're going to get into this heavy, but just, you know, he's going to write one sentence. That's called a resha, the opening sentence. Then he's going to have a sefer, which is the closing sentence, and he's going to leave out the middle, and he's going to use all sorts, he's going to rely on all sorts of logical principles for you to derive, well, what would be the middle case that's between A and Z, you know, somewhere in the middle. And so forth and so on. It's almost as if the Mishnah was hidden in a certain way. It was written so abridged. And that opened up the need for other literature. And that other literature was not included in the formal text of the Mishnah, but was written during a period, I would say, of three centuries. From the year 200 to the year 500. What was going on for those three centuries? Here we get into a period of time which, and again, if you had pen and paper, in this case, I would force you to write this down. Because up until and including Rav Yehuda HaNasi, we are dealing with scholars who are called by a certain appellation, a certain title, and that title is very important for us. You know, even though you may say, Rabbi, what's in the title? Call me Rabbi, call me Chief Rabbi, call me Rabbi of the City, Rabbi of the Town, what difference does it make? Here it's very important. Up until and including Rav Yehuda HaNasi, what are those sages called? Tannoim. Again, if I had it, I would write it out for you. But in English, it would be T-A-N-A-I-M. Tannaim. You'll write it in any way that you find comfortable. Okay, that's the plural. The singular is a tan. So Rav Yehuda HaNasi is the end of the period of Tannaim. He's the last tan. Tana means a teacher. No. Because right after Rav Yehuda HaNasi, for three centuries, we have another period of time that's called Amoraim. Once again, you're going to have to write this down. I don't expect you to memorize it, unless you're a genius. Amoraim. A-M- O R A I M. Singular, Amora. Amora means a speaker. In the old days, they didn't have loudspeakers like we have today or microphones. So what they had was they had a person who was in charge of the transmission of the Torah, and he had a sidekick. What was his sidekick's job? He would scream out the Torah so that if there were hundreds of students in the academy, they could all hear the lesson, because the teacher himself may have been elderly or he had to lecture on a regular basis. He couldn't project his voice. So that's how they came up with the term Amora. Amora is the one who projects the voice, but in this case, projects the voice on behalf of the Rebbe. The Rebbe himself is called an Amora. So for example, in the first period of Amoraim, we have Rav, we have Rabbi Yochanan, we have Rabbi Chia. Now, all these names are very, very famous. I'll tell you why. Because each one of the three names, there were hundreds of them, but the three that I chose to mention, Rav, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Chia, were all authors of texts, the purpose of which was to elucidate those abridged Mishnah texts that were authored by Rav Yehuda Hanasi. So, for example, Rav, who was first generation Amora, probably around the year 200 and change, you know, a little bit after Rav Yehuda Hanasi, he authored a book called the Sifra, which again you should write down. Well, the Sifra is actually on one section, segment of the Torah, and the Sifri is on a different segment of the Torah. The two together form, in a sense, a whole. So Rav edited the Sifra and the Sifri. Does anybody know Rav Yochanan, what he edited? That's called the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is a very, very popular elucidation of the Mishnah. Very difficult to understand. A lot of the texts are unclear and have to be clarified. Reb Chiya, I mentioned, he edited something called the Tosefta. Have you heard of the Tosefta? If you haven't, you heard of it now. Not to be confused with Tosfot. And then later, Rav Hoshaya and Bar Kappara got together and they created what's called the Braitot, or in Ashkenazic pronunciation, the Braisos. It doesn't matter either way. The Braisos are again elucidations of the Mishnah that were left out of the Mishnah. So again, you have a whole superstructure here. You've got Rav Yehuda Hanasi, who is probably the greatest scholar in early Hebraic language. And not only was he a great literary scholar, which he certainly was, he was also a great leader of his people, but he also was a revolutionary. And he came at a point in Jewish history where God placed him there deliberately so he could save the boat that was sinking. And he edited the Mishnah, divided up into six different sections called the Shisha Sidre Mishnah. Hence the word Shas, if you've ever heard of it. Shas is not just a political party, I want you to know. Shas actually stands for Shisha Sidre, meaning the six orders of the Mishnah. But the Mishnah was written in such a terse, abridged form that it produced an entire literature that sprung up over the next three centuries of elucidations of the Mishnah. Now, this period of three centuries, which is called the period of the Amoraim, terminates with two great scholars, Ravina and Ravashi. Ravina, a little bit less so. The real completer of the entire process is Ravashi. And Ravashi is the final Amora who takes it upon himself to compile what we call the Gemara.
You're talking just the Bavli?
Or Bavli. Yerushalmi was edited two centuries earlier, probably in the year 300, by Rav Yochanan. But during the next two centuries, a great mass of literature evolved. And that literature was formulated into the Gemara around the year 500. Now take a wild guess. How long did this process take to actually, from beginning to end, to actually compile the Gemara? 60 years.
Not 300?
No, again, the discussions that were going on over the course of centuries gradually were developed and passed on as elucidations of the Gemara. Of the Mishnah. But the actual process of sitting down and editing one work that would consolidate all the scholarship of those three centuries was the process of creating Gemara, which was complete in the year 500 at the end of a 60-year period. There was a 30-year period, let's say around the year 440 to the Common Era, in which all these discussions were compiled together. And around the year 470, these discussions were edited and formulated in the Gemara.
That's the nine cycles of Daf Yomi.
Yeah, that's a long period of time. But what is the Gemara? We still come back to the original question. And this is the critical point. What the Gemara is, first and foremost, on a simple, superficial level, an attempt to understand the Mishnah. But it goes beyond that, my friends. What the Gemara really is a record of the disputes, of the discussions, of the dissections, of the analysis, of the process through which the Torah was clarified. Now, I don't know if you understand a word I just said, so let me try it again, because I certainly didn't. What I want to say is the following, my friends. One of the questions I wanted to address tonight, and now is the place to address it, is the true or false? The Gemara is a compendium, a code of halachic decisions. False. Absolutely false. You want a code? Go to the Shulchan Aruch. Again, there are precedents, antecedents to the Shulchan Aruch. That's not for now. But certainly not the Gemara. What is the Gemara? The Gemara is the process, the development, the analysis. Now I'm going to use an Aramaic term here. Again, I'm trying to avoid those like the plague tonight, but this one I can't avoid. There's an Aramaic term called Shakla Vitaria. Maybe you've heard of it. How many people in this room ever heard of that phrase, Shakla Vitaria? Okay. Shakla Vitaria is the dissection, the analysis. What a rabbi says, you know what the source for this law is? It's the following verse in the Torah. And the other one says it can't be. And he brings the proof against it. And then another Amora gets up and he says, no, I have an answer to that proof, a counter argument. And so forth and so on. Now what we're going to do, not tonight, because I want to leave this for a separate discussion, is to try to understand what kinds of questions and arguments and proof texts form the fabric, the background of the Gemara. This is something that people, I'm telling you, my friends, people study Gemara for decades and decades, and they never stop and take a step back and try to think, what, how do you classify? What is the methodology of the Gemara? What is the thinking of the Gemara? How does the Gemara go from stage one to stage two, from a question to an answer, from an answer to a counter question, from an argument to a proof text? What are those proof texts? And so, for example, if an Amora will call him X, makes a statement, and an Amora will call him Y, brings a text that rejects the first argument, it's a contradiction. Then we go back to Amora X, and we want to defend him. Or maybe he's going to defend himself. How does he go about doing that? Does he reject the text and say, well, I'm more important? But what if the text is a Mishnah? Now, who authored the Mishnah? I mean, who are the scholars that are included in the Mishnah? Tanoim. Well, you're an Amora. Hey, this is what we call in basketball a foul. Meaning, hey, the technical rules of the game are such that an Amora cannot argue with a Tana. And maybe we'll get into that. That's another hour discussion why that's so. So, if an Amora can't argue with a Tana, if one Amora disproves another Amora with a Mishnah, can the first Amora defend himself by saying, well, I disagree with the Mishnah? He can't do that. Why? Because if he's disagreeing with the Mishnah, then he's disagreeing with a Tana. That's a foul.
Well, he can argue that they're talking about something else.
Okay, so then we want to break it down. Now, there are five different ways that he can deal with this question. But the one way that he cannot deal with this question is to say, well, I disagree with the Mishnah. Okay, that's a very important rule. You may laugh at it, but it's very important. And to understand why that works and how that evolved and what the basis for that is very, very important.
What was the period of the Tanoim?
The period of Tanoim was up until Rabbi Yehuda Nasi.
When did it start?
It began more or less 100 years before the Churban HaBayis. So we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of years. And all those rabbis are called with the name Rebbe.
By Rishon or?
Well, I don't know about by Rishon. I'm talking about by Chain. You know. So why are they called Rebbe?
Rabbis.
Just one question. When you see a Gemara, how do you identify if Rabbi so and so is a Tana or an Amora? Now I'm going to ask my advanced students over here. But maybe you never even thought about it. When you see Rabbi so and so in the Gemara,
Rebbe so and so is a Tana.
Oh, excellent. Why? why is the appellation Rebbe indicative of a Tana and Rav of an Amora? Correct, it has to do with Smicha. Because the Tanoim had a direct, unbroken chain, what's called Ish Mipi Ish, from one person to the other, that linked them back to Moshe Rabbeinu, who gave Smicha to Yoshua and to the Zekanim. So what you're talking about in the case of a Tana, again, this is a whole hour's discussion, which we're not going to get into now, is we're talking about Rebbe, which means... Now, there are a few Tanoim that don't have the name Rebbe to it. Two of the most famous of which are Shammai and Hillel. Why isn't he called Rebbe Hillel? Why is he called Rebbe Shammai? And Shammai and Hillel play such a major role in the development of the Mishnah that Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, when he authored the Mishnah, he dedicates almost an entire Masechta, which is called Edios, just to summarize the disputes between Hillel and Shammai. And yet they weren't called Rebbe. What's that all about? Okay, I'm hitting you with a lot of questions. Why was the Talmud Bavli accepted and not the Yerushalmi? That's another question.
Forget it.
Okay.
Yeah, go
ahead.
I got it already.
Why is it so important that we capture the analysis? Why not just give me the bottom line? Well, let me ask you a different question. If you had a choice between studying Gemara and studying Mishnah Brura, or Kaf HaChaim, or Rav Avad Yosef's Tshuvas, you know, Bia Omer, Yechav Das, or Yalkut Yosef, whatever it might be, whatever your favorite halacha sefer is. No? I'd say, wait a minute. You know, my time is limited. I'm not going to be the next Rashi Bahag, the next scholar of the generation. I'm not responsible for the transmission of the oral Torah. Let me study halacha. Let me open up a Mishnah Brura. Whatever your favorite halacha sefer is, here, this is, I'm not giving a pitch for the Mishnah Brura. It's not. What?
Not an
Edios
Mishnah
Brura. No, this is not an endorsement for the Mishnah Brura. I tell you the truth. When I was in high school, so I remember that we came back from gym and we went to art class. So the art teacher didn't like the fact that we were disheveled. You know, when we came, you come from gym. I don't know if you remember. So we had that success. So he says, put those strings back into your pants. So one guy gets up, he says, Mr. Getter, he was the art teacher. If he's alive, he's 150. I don't know. So even on Canadian terms, that's for you. But so he says to him, but the Mishnah Brura says, so he slams him. He says, I don't care what you do in Mr. Brewer's class. In my class, you put him back. The point is, I'm not here to endorse the Mishnah Brura. Whatever is your but if you have a limited amount of time, why not dedicate it to the study of halakha? This way you know how to do it and what to do it.
Well, you said it earlier, didn't you? It's all about the process.
What's beautiful about the Gemara and what makes it unique, and I don't know if there's any other book. I mean, I'm not a scholar to answer this question, but I intuitively I sense there's no other book like it in any nation of the world where you're getting a historical but yet an analytic study of the development of the law. Now ask yourself the following question: what do I have to know about the development of the law? Give me the bottom line. So, you know, like my wife says to me, right, we're married now 33 years. She said, 33 years, she said to me, Azaria, tell me the bottom line. You know, she asked me a question, you know, this got mixed up with that, you know what I'm saying? So I tell, well, if, you know, they give her a whole, you know, 2-hour lecture. I married you because you're a rabbi, tell me the bottom line. You know what I'm saying? So I want to know the bottom line. Why do I have to study Gemara? So what I'd like to do now, just how much time we have, about 5 more minutes, I want to tell you 3 classical answers to this question. But I have a different answer. That's what I'm going to tell you now. I'm not going to give it to you tonight. I want you to think about the 3 classics. And this is what I came up with. The classical answers to the question, why study Gemara? Number 1, because we have to preserve the oral tradition. As we said before, the Torah was given in the division of oral and written. If we don't study the Gemara, then we will never be able to be part of that chain of passing on the oral tradition as God wanted it. So by studying the Gemara, the Torah, we connect ourselves back to our Sinai. We're sort of part of a historical process. We're really jumping back into history by turning the clock back almost 2,000 years. Well, at least 1,500 years. And therefore, we get a deeper insight into the Torah. We understand the underlying principles. That's one answer. The second answer, which is again a classical answer, based on a Tanchuma in Parshas Noach, this week's Parsha, the Tanchuma says that the key to the love of God, to coming to Avat Hashem, is the study of the Talmud and the Gemara. Why? He says because if you study Halakha, it's spoon-fed to you. It's placed right in front of you. You don't have to work, you don't have to toil, there's no mesirut nefesh. You know, you're not giving yourself up. However, this is very difficult. To study Gemara is difficult. The Tanchuma uses an unbelievable phrase. The Tanchuma calls Gemara she, and writes, she is severe as death. That's how difficult it is. The study of Gemara requires dedication. It requires withdrawal to some extent from this world, because you got to put in your time. You can't be involved in hedonistic pleasures, you know, day and night, and then expect to become of an expert in Gemara. So this process of detachment from the world in order to be attached to Gemara is a process of love of God to such an extent that Gemara tells the Kiddushin on Daf Lamed that Barasa Yetzahara, that God says I created an evil inclination, so they wouldn't have freedom of choice. But sometimes the evil inclination is very strong. Is Barati Torah Talmud. The antidote against the power of the evil inclination is the study of Torah, specifically Torah Shebal Peh. So let's just go over the two reasons. Number one, we become part of the process, we jump into the history, we get a deeper understanding of the Torah because we understand the entire evolution, the development of Halakha, the development of Torah Shebal Peh. Number two, because Torah Shebal Peh is a process that we have to work and hard, it's hard work and sweat and toil, and that's a process of love of God. And number three, the intellectual and emotional growth through the study of Torah. The Mishnah tells us in Masechet Avot HaLomed Torah L'Shma, if somebody studies Torah for its sake, for the sake of the knowledge of the Torah, Zochel Edvarim Harben, he merits many things. He's uplifted, he's impacted. He's changed. He's a different personality. By studying the Torah, he develops analytic skills. But more than that, through the dedication to Torah Shebal Peh, the oral, he develops honesty. Why honesty? Because he tries to understand Rav, and then he tries to understand Abaye, two famous Amoraim, and then back to Rav, and back to Abaye, constantly analyzing. Never siding with one until he's absolutely convinced that one is right. Always looking at the pros and cons, the different points of view. He's training his mind and his heart to think the way the Torah wants him to think. By imitating the pathways and the approach to Torah, he changes himself. And what is the Torah? The Torah is Chochmat Hashem. It's the wisdom of God. We believe that the wisdom of God is embodied, is expressed in the Torah. So the more he analyzes the Torah, the more he delves into it, emotionally, he becomes connected to the Chochmah, to that great wisdom of God Himself. Values become implanted in his very soul, because learning a halakha from a Mishnah Berurah again is a little bit cold, intellectual, it's dry. It's really just amassing knowledge. It's memorization. It doesn't have that much of an impact. But if he dedicates himself to understand the process, to elucidate the ideas, to analyze the svarot, the logic, and see what the halakha has to say to him, then slowly but surely, the study of Torah on this level has an impact on his soul. So again, three explanations, and God willing, next week, same time, same station if we can, 7:30 on Sunday if you'll be here, I would like to suggest my own interpretation, my answer to the question, why we should be studying tomorrow. Okay then? So I want to take up to thank everyone again for joining me tonight, and hope to see you next week.